Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and go to Cairo, Egypt to speak with Thanasi Kambanis, the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. With a tense situation in Lebanon following the UN indictments of four members of Hezbollah accused of assassinating former Lebanese Prime Minister Hariri, we will talk about the wider regional implications of this explosive situation that is akin to the Guns of August tinderbox that preceded World War I. Then we'll examine further the scenario based on warnings from senior Israeli intelligence officials that Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu will launch a war against Iran as early as September. MJ Rosenberg joins us. He is a senior fellow at Media Matters, focusing on foreign policy and Middle East affairs. We will discuss the domestic political implications on the forthcoming elections should such a scenario unfold. Then finally, we'll speak with David Leventhal, the editor of a new report by the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics, From Hired Guns to Hired Hands. We will discuss the apparent lack of shame in Washington, D.C., where it is becoming more and more business as usual to trade public service for private gain, as the revolving door between lobbyists and congressional staffers spins faster and faster. Joining us now from Cairo, Egypt, is Thanasi Kambanis, who is the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. Thanasi Kambanis was the Boston Globe's Middle East Bureau Chief and now writes regularly for the New York Times as a freelance journalist. He also teaches journalism and foreign policy at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thanasi Kambanis.
Great to talk to you, Ian.
And Monday's New York Times had an editorial titled, The Long Pursuit of Justice in Lebanon. No matter what Hezbollah says, the men accused of Rafik Hariri's murder must be arrested. So easier said than done.
Yeah, I mean, the it would be a fool's bet to expect those four Hezbollah operatives named in the indictment to ever actually be arrested. You'll recall, and you might have talked about this last night with your guest Bob Baer, for decades there was an international manhunt for Imad Muhniyeh, who was Hezbollah's head of operations and was responsible for a lot of the major attacks on American targets in the 80s. That man was never caught, never captured. Eventually he was assassinated in 2008 in Damascus after a nearly three-decade international search. And if anything, that's the kind of result that we might see in this case. But we're very unlikely to see these people being actually found and arrested and put on trial.
Well, there's a fear, obviously, that pressure on Hezbollah, who are the de facto power now in Lebanon, will result in a resumption of the civil war. And, of course, the person who was largely credited with ending the civil war and healing the country was Hariri himself, the man who was assassinated and whose death has resulted in two UN tribunals, the second one finally coming out with the indictments against these four Hezbollah people, which I think if they're not arrested by August, I believe it is, then an international manhunt will begin. That's the countdown, right?
Right. And in practical terms, the tribunal has a process built in to put these people on trial in absentia. So if, as I would predict, they never get arrested, the court at some point, I forget what the time frame is, can go ahead and initiate proceedings. They'll be tried in absentia, and you know, if convicted, they'll have outstanding sentences against them. But really, I mean, the danger when people talk about this leading to civil war, the danger would lie in somehow a scenario where either the international community or the Lebanese government actually goes in, so to speak, with guns blazing into Hezbollah areas and really tries to force the issue and capture these guys, sort of, you know, an Osama bin Laden manhunt kind of situation. And that, in my view, is just never going to happen. I mean, in the reality of Lebanon's fragmented power structure in which Hezbollah holds the majority, if not all, the cards, there's simply no one strong enough to even make an effort to do this, much less to sort of mount a credible attempt to really arrest a Hezbollah person. So I think we'll see a lot of political rhetoric, but I can't even see a player who would be strong enough on the scene to sort of turn over the deck of cards and turn this into a real shootout.
Well, I think though the reason this is a subject I think of great interest beyond the UN tribunal and these four Hezbollah who have been indicted, this could be a flashpoint for a region that is teetering. Whether you've got the Syrian regime next door teetering, and we've already seen how Bashar al-Assad, first of all, he's blaming all of his problems at home on the Israelis and the Americans, which is what Hezbollah does as well. But he clearly tried to play the Palestinian card by threatening Israel and by creating problems for Israel, which I think was a way of telling the Israelis, you know, if I go, I'm going to make life miserable for you. And I think surely the same is happening in Lebanon, surely. Aren't the Syrians basically saying, if you push too far, we can really screw this place up?
You know, I think you're absolutely right that this could be a flashpoint for a wider conflict, and that Hezbollah would be one of the key destabilizing ingredients. The only difference in emphasis I would put is that I don't think it's the tribunal that's going to be the issue that puts their back up against the wall. I think you put your finger on it when you talked about the insecurity or the threat to the Assad regime, and that's where we get the weak link that could really set off a regional war. And the problem there is this: Syria is one of the two main backers of Hezbollah, along with Iran. And if you look at a map, you see exactly why Syria is so important. They share the land border. They effectively envelope Lebanon. That's where all the weapons come in. That's the strategic depth that allows Hezbollah to be such a formidable army. Now, Hezbollah looks around and sees its sponsor in Damascus on the verge perhaps of losing its regime, and they've come out very strongly in support of Assad, which by the way runs very counter to their usual position of being against Arab dictators. And I think if they see Syria about to go down in flames, or not Syria but the Syrian regime that has been its guarantor, I think they will do anything within their power, anything short of destroying their own organization, to keep that lifeline and pipeline open to them. And that is a very dangerous position for the region to be in.
Again, I'm speaking with Thanasi Kambanis, author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And we're speaking to Thanasi in Cairo, Egypt. Within the Lebanese government, of course, you have this the son of the murdered former prime minister, the head of the Future Movement, a former prime minister, Saad Hariri. He's basically saying that the bottom line is that there'll be no national dialogue unless they can discuss the issue of Hezbollah's arsenal, and that seems to be the breaking point. And of course, most of the members of the future movement say that Hezbollah is a tool of Bashar al-Assad, and that this is in fact the current prime minister is in fact a Makati. He's in fact a Hezbollah Syrian tool. So you got a kind of divided standoff and a stalemate there politically,
right? And let's try and untangle that mess of conflicting loyalties and interests here, and look at the cleavages that are most important for us and sort of most dangerous for the region. And I would say the biggest thing that's emerged from this is that the whole issue has been turned for a lot of people into a sectarian Sunni Shia issue. So whatever Rafiq Hariri represented at the time of his death in 2005, and whatever Hezbollah represented at the time as well, when Hezbollah was a sort of anti-Israeli umbrella resistance group and Hariri was a symbol of the rejuvenation of Lebanon, well, now for many people it's become Rafiq Hariri, a great Sunni leader, and Hezbollah, the great Shia hope. And that is the kind of thinking and the kind of polarization that did pave the way to a civil war in Lebanon, and unless we forget the relevance of that, that also fueled the far more murderous civil war in Iraq that still flares up to this day. And that kind of thinking, I find probably one of the scariest long-term legacies of this the murder and then the effort to bring it, the killers of Hariri to justice. Because in my view, whatever happened with Hariri was more complex than that. I mean, it certainly must have involved Syrian intelligence. It must have involved Hezbollah operatives who have such control on the ground, and it probably involved Lebanese intelligence as well. But today, it's a Sunni-Shia question, and that, frankly, riles people up a lot more than complex politics.
And, of course, the situation in Syria is a Sunni, Alawite, and Shia divide with a 15% minority against an 80% majority of Sunni. And I don't know whether you were able to hear all of the interview I did yesterday with Bob Baer, but it was pretty disturbing, his analysis based upon statements from senior Israeli intelligence officials that Prime Minister Netanyahu is determined to attack Iran, and may well happen as soon as September before Palestinians declare statehood. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, it's a terrifying cost-benefit analysis, because you know, a few years ago, I would have said that there were a lot of mitigating factors in the region. A lot of the most violent players had built-in incentives for calm. They were likely to do better with peace than war, even if they were largely belligerent. Now that's turned over on its head. So you and Bob talked about the Israeli and the Iranian calculus and to the Syrian calculus, and let's throw into that Hezbollah's as well. Hezbollah needs war if its domestic legitimacy is threatened, and it needs war if its viability as a militant movement is threatened. So either force, and right now those forces are coming down it from both directions, right? Inside Lebanon, there's a groundswell of support for bringing Hezbollah to trial and convicting it for this murder. Outside of Lebanon, its two biggest patrons are under attack, Syrian's regime literally, and that's the kind of moment where Hezbollah could see this as an existential issue and might well view it in their interest. Forget about what Syria wants or what Iran wants or Israel wants. Hezbollah might see it in its interest to spark a war with Israel, which, among other things, would rally a lot of Arabs in support of Syria and of Hezbollah. I mean, even if Hezbollah starts a war, once the war starts, everybody's going to side with the Arab underdog in the face of the Israeli Goliath, and that's really the trump card they hold, and they have access to that more so than a state like Syria. I think it's a little harder for a government like Syria, even in its current precarious situation, to just start a war. Hezbollah can do it any day. With there's always a little border dispute. There's always a little tension between the Israeli troops on one side of the border and the Hezbollah fighters on the other. And any one of those daily tiny things that we don't even hear about in the news could serve as the pretext for the movement to start a war if they so wanted.
Well, surely, though, if a war were to happen between Israel and Iran, the Israelis would simultaneously strike Iran and Hezbollah, wouldn't they?
You know, that's a question there's been a lot of debate on, and my position has always been that Hezbollah would not attack on Iran's behalf. That in general, Hezbollah does not want to be seen by its followers as serving the interests of a foreign nation. Its wars and its militant activity are always framed in terms of protecting Lebanon or protecting Hezbollah's ability to wage resistance against Israel. So, in the event of an Israeli attack on Iran, I think Hezbollah would be hard pressed to simply jump in. Now, if Israel attacked, of course they would counterattack, and they would, you know, perhaps be thrilled to have the pretext. And I believe that Israel might in fact refrain from attacking Hezbollah as well. I mean, if it thinks it could keep calm on its northern border while having a war with Iran, I think it would do so if it could.
Well, in both cases, if Israel attacked either Iran or Hezbollah, it would be a gift to Iran and Hezbollah. I think that was pretty much established in the conversations yesterday with...
Right, and sorry, I want to be clear. These actors have a long history of miscalculating. So
sure.
everything I said that sort of hinges on calm and clear assessments of their own self-interest and how a war would unfold... to be realistic in the environment that we've had over the last couple of decades, every time there's been a crisis, especially the Hezbollah and the Israelis have overshot, miscalculated, jumped the gun, and have been all too willing to sort of make a bad scenario into the worst case scenario. So probably the smart bet would be on either the worst or the sort of the dumbest strategic decision making.
Well, I think what we're talking about here, in a way, is a kind of Guns of August pre-World War I situation. And again, I'm speaking with Thanasi Kambanis, author of A Privilege to Die: Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And he's talking to us from Cairo, Egypt. And I was not able to talk about this subject that we're talking about today with Bob Bay yesterday because he was an investigator for the UN Tribunal and is under a gag order. But he has been threatened by Hezbollah's leader, Sheikh Nasrallah.
I don't think Bob Bear is on Hezbollah's sort of birthday card list. I don't think they're big fans of his. Certainly his role working with the tribunal was a good opportunity for them to demonize both him, but I think more importantly for their purposes, the tribunal itself. In his speech this past week, Nasrallah spent a lot of time explaining once again to his supporters how, in his view, the tribunal is simply an Israeli and American plot to enslave Lebanon to the interests of the West. One of the pieces of evidence that he very proudly trotted out was Bob's role as an investigator for the tribunal. In fact, Nasrallah listed by name several of the investigators who worked in the tribunal and explained their own CVs and their connections to the CIA or the FBI, their ties to Israel, and used that to show that, of course, the entire project of blaming Hezbollah is simply part of a Western Israeli-American plot to frame the honorable resistance as evildoers. It seems incredible from the outside, but virtually everyone in Hezbollah's community has for years now been 100% convinced that the murder of Hariri and, in fact, all the political assassinations in Lebanon were done by Israel. And Nasrallah has proved this, in air quotes, to his followers using sophisticated projections of drone footage and these sort of complicated circumstantial evidence cases and facts like Bob Baer's presence on the team that investigated the murders to provide what they see as an airtight case that Israel did this. And now, when I look at this case, it seems almost laughable. I mean, it's not something that would... I think even a two-bit defense attorney would trot out in a criminal court in the States, but it's been enough for his followers, and that kind of thing really motivates people and really sells. And the idea that if a former CIA officer was pinning this crime on Hezbollah, that's all the explanation you need in order to blow off the entire process if you're a Hezbollah loyalist.
Sure, and to that extent, Bob was tailor-made for Nasrallah, but. Nasrallah added a whole other bill of particulars against Bob and Hezbollah's. I wouldn't want to be on their hit list. Shall we say that? Because they've hit a lot of people around the world. In the last couple of minutes, though, I just wanted to ask you about the position there in how this is looked upon, particularly what's happening in Syria, where you are in Cairo, Egypt, because the Egyptians who led their revolution have their own problems and the extent to which the military are dragging out the process of of the fruits of revolution, if you will, and they're making the cutting these secret deals with the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, the revolution in Cairo is really entering another activist phase. The people who took it to the streets in January and February and toppled Mubarak, at this point feel like almost nothing has changed since the president left. The same military generals are running the country with the same structures, and frankly, they're right. I mean, it's still a military dictatorship, and there still has not been any firm timeline placed to put Egypt under civilian authority. So I think the Egyptians feel, on the one hand, lucky when they look at Syria and Libya. They see their brothers in the Arab Spring being killed wholesale by dictatorships that are taking a maximalist position to crush dissent. On the other hand, they feel like they're in a pretty tough position as well. I mean, several dozens of Egyptians have been killed in clashes since the revolution with the army, and the army has really been reluctant to give up any of its prerogatives. So I think for the view from Cairo is that Egypt is in a fortunate position. I mean, that it's more likely than most of the states in upheaval to get some substantial change without having a lot more people die. But they did have 1,000 people killed, and I think they look with a lot of pride at their fellows in Syria and Libya and Yemen, who are standing firm and really, being killed daily or weekly as they stand up for these ideals.
I share that feeling too. I'm astounded at the courage of particularly the young Syrians. Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Thanasi Kambanis.
Great to talk to you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Thanasi Kambanis, author of Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. He spoke to us from Cairo, Egypt. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a minute.